Hello, and welcome to the Big Web Show, Everything Web That Matters. It's the launch of the dawning of Aquarius. It's actually the launch of CSS Grid. It's real, it's here, and with me is one of the people who has been guiding us for 3 or 4 years now on the topic, writer, developer, product creator, Rachel Andrew. Hi, Rachel.
Hello, it's good to be here.
You're in the UK right now.
I am, yes.
Where do you live?
I'm in Bristol.
Bristol.
So that's the sort of southwest, heading down towards Cornwall, out of London. You go through Bristol, which is a nice part of the world.
Is it a seafaring town?
There's a port, so it's kind of in from the coast a bit. But it's an old industrial town, very like where I'm. Yeah, it's kind of like where I'm from. I'm from Newcastle up in the northeast, which again is a sort of old shipbuilding and things, that sort of town.
I know Newcastle.
It's a nice place to be. There's a lot going on.
Cool. Before we get into it, I'd like to share with our listeners a few of your credits, if you don't mind.
Okay.
So, Rachel Andrew is a web developer, writer, and public speaker from the UK. She is the author or co-author of 30 books, including this year's Get Ready for last year's Get Ready for CSS Grid Layout, World Book Apart, CSS3 Layout Modules, The Profitable Side Project Handbook, going back as far as, and probably go further than this, the ASP Web Development with Macromedia Dreamweaver.
Yep.
Okay. You're the co-author of A Pocket Guide to CSS Modules, Everything You Know About CSS Is Wrong, HTML5 for Web Designers, Second Edition, that one with Jeremy Keith, and I reckon about 25 others.
Yeah, there's quite a few.
Member of the CSS Working Group, Google Developer Expert, and co-founder of the and co-runner, producer, customer service person, product developer, everything, basically co-everything, on the Perch CMS, which is a great little CMS designed specifically for designer developers. And pretty much every day she has been writing guides, especially in the last weeks, it seems like every day you've been writing a new article. You wrote about CSS grid guides on MDM like yesterday. Rachel also publishes and writes CSS Layout News, which is a weekly collection of tutorials, news, and information on all things CSS layout. Articles you've written recently include 3 years with CSS Grid Layout, CSS Grid Layout Lands in Firefox 52. How do you do it?
I write fast.
And you run, right? And you're physically active, right? So it's not. And you have admittedly grown child, but you're a mom and have a child.
Yeah.
So how? And you've been a very, very active member of this community for 20 years. So how?
By being very organized, mostly.
Really?
I sort of enjoy doing stuff. With the writing particularly, I tend to think by writing and I think by creating examples, and then it seems like it would be crazy not to publish these things, so I just do.
So you figure it out for yourself, in a way you write for yourself.
Yeah, I'm one of these people with no kind of ability to sort of see things. I don't have any way of visualizing anything. So if I want to sort of work anything out, I have to build it. I have to build examples. I have to write about it to kind of understand how it's going to work. So that tends to be what I do. And so I'm doing that for myself. And once I've got all this stuff, well, I might as well share it.
We're very glad you do. And I also know, what you mean in a different way. I have a similar issue because I don't know what I think unless I write about, I know what I think like, oh, this pizza's good, but I don't know what I think about, design, development, or even politics. I mean, I have knee-jerk reactions like everybody does these days, but if I really want to understand something, I have to investigate and write things down. And I've always loved that part of it, the research and then sharing. I think that's...
Yeah, there's something about putting something down in words. It makes you go over it and think, oh, yeah, maybe I've got that wrong and I need to go and check that. and sort of test those assumptions. There's something about writing as opposed to just speaking that, that helps you do that.
But you also constantly create demos, which is just wonderful, right? And that's never been a strong suit of mine. But you've always, so you're like, does this layout mean that I can do this? Now, you said something the other day about, I mean, first of all, CSS grid layout specification has been around in one form or another since April 2011.
Certainly the current sort of spec, yeah.
And it began finding its way into browsers behind Flags and so on. That took about a year, maybe longer?
Yeah, well, there was this initial implementation in IE10, which is what's still in IE and Edge today, because the spec kind of came from Microsoft. It was the editors on the initial spec were from Microsoft. They implemented their sort of initial version of Grid into IE10, which I actually wrote about at the time. I was like, this is neat, you know. Yeah. And there's certainly an awful lot of what is the current spec is there. There's an awful lot that isn't there because it was the sort of first version. And then there was a kind of less complexity. Yeah, less complexity, and it doesn't do half the things that the new spec does. But they haven't updated their implementation as yet, which is a bit of a shame.
They will though. I mean, they don't get enough credit.
Oh no! I mean, there's a ton of stuff that the Microsoft team have done.
The Microsoft Edge is amazing.
Yeah.
And really, back in the day, before things happened that made everyone so angry at Microsoft, I mean, they introduced CSS. They didn't invent the spec, but they introduced basic CSS in IE3, like years before it found its way into other browsers.
Well, you know, I think people forget that when IE6 came out, we were all so thrilled.
Yes.
Because it supported so much of the stuff that let us do CSS positioning. We were all excited, but you know, at the Web Standards Project, we were recommending that people upgraded to IE6. It hung around for too long, you know.
It's like rock bands, you know. First they're like, there's only a small cult that's following them, and then they become popular and everybody loves them, and then third or fourth album they're like, oh, they're played out. I mean, it's sad. It's like a music career or an acting career, right? Most acting careers, like, you know, you look at the people who were like huge in the 90s, and then by 2005 they're not getting work anymore. It's sad. And I think we've had that history with browsers where like IE5 Mac came out, and when that came out, spearheaded by Tantek Celik, people were like, oh my gosh, we finally really have CSS. This is fantastic. But a few years later, we were like, why won't IE5 die? Right? You remember? And we did the same with IE6, and IE6 took a long time to die, man. Grandma was on that respirator for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, that was the problem, really, with that browser, was that it hung around for too long. And
that was the problem. They didn't.
There's a whole generation, I think, of web people who probably came into web development at the point at which IE6 was an old browser but was still there. And so you can understand why people, you know, were so angry about that and so fed up.
And before that, there was a generation that came out when IE6 was new and thought, and they didn't, at that time, we hadn't really done the best job yet of getting the standards message fully out to our community. So a lot of people looked at it as like, oh, IE6 is the standard, right? There was this period where clients would say, companies would say to their in-house team, we're developing for IE6 now, and that didn't seem crazy to anybody. Well, Netscape, hasn't come out with a 6 yet, and fewer people are using Netscape. There were a lot of reasons why. Netscape, for the children in the audience, being the forebear of Firefox, right? Mm. We have Mozilla, we have Firefox because of Netscape. Mm-hmm. Which not everybody was around for that, but yeah, and so here's this spec. This is 2017. I'm always helping my daughter with her math homework. That's 6 years.
Yeah, it's the up to date version of the spec kind of started to come into Chrome, I guess, sort of 4 years or so ago.
Yeah.
You know, there was a period between the IE10 version launching, and then the spec changed, and I was writing and talking about that spec before there was really a browser implementation of it. So I was kind of trying to explain it to people and saying, well, I can't show you this yet working in anything, but this is how it's going to be. And then it was really great because it started to appear in Chrome, thanks to the work of the people over at Egalia, who've been doing that implementation. And from that point, it was fantastic. So we were able to actually build stuff and show people it and build demos and explain how to turn on browser flags and things.
The first CSS book I read was a theoretical book. And the author had seen a potential implementation in IE3. This was in 1996. So he wrote about what the IE team thought and what was probably going to be in IE3. And I don't know how people do that. When you began evangelizing this pretty early on, what's it like to do that when there's no way of actually testing what you're saying? You can't build a demo and you can't show anybody anything. How do you even, I mean, what do you say?
Yeah.
As I read the spec.
Yeah. It was kind of an interesting challenge for me because all of the writing I'd done before then had been taking sort of well-known concepts and just explaining them for people. So, you know, I'd find a demo that someone had built and they hadn't really explained, and I'd say, hey, look, here's a really cool thing and here's how you do it. And so a lot of my writing until I started doing the grid stuff was about things that very much existed. You know, there was no problem explaining it and showing it. But I wanted to take that ability to explain things simply, which I have, and is something I'm quite good at, is just sort of taking something and breaking it down and teaching it. I thought, well, what about doing that with this thing that doesn't exist? And how do you do that? And so I've kind of been playing with that ever since, you know, how to explain something that is a little bit sketchy at the moment and get people excited about it, because I really didn't want grid layout to go away. I wanted to make sure that, you know, the foot was kept on the pedal sort of thing, and this was going to ship.
I think a couple of you and Jen Simmons, I think by your evangelism, helped make sure that we would get grid, that helped make sure that it didn't go away. And I want to ask, this is the first layout-focused CSS ever. CSS was never a layout language, right? It was, well, we called it that. We all said it was. But that wasn't strictly true. It was really a type language. I mean, if controlling the size of type is layout, so in that sense it's true, but columns and things were never part of it. And why did it take almost 20 years into the web's history, or more than that, before, I mean, if the first CSS came out in 96, why did it take till 2011 for somebody, a Microsoft team, not even the W3C, to say, you know, maybe we should actually design something that's for layout? Did everybody think that floats were good enough? I mean, they're very fragile.
I don't know. I think these ideas have been around for a very, very long time. The stuff that is in grid template areas has been floating around for years, you know, well before what Microsoft did. And it kind of got merged into that spec. So this sort of ASCII art syntax. You can find that in specs going back quite a long way.
Yes, I remember the ASCII part.
So I think these things have been thought about, but I think the problem is with layout is that there hasn't actually been a lot of authors, you know, web developers saying we need this, because people kind of got their methods of doing stuff and just sort of carried on using them. You know, you don't find people, you know, 6-7 years ago demanding better layout methods. It just wasn't happening.
Right.
It was like, oh, well, we've figured out how to work around this. We've built, you know, some frameworks or whatever.
We were happy with tables.
Yeah. Even with responsive, no one was demanding new CSS to do it particularly. They were like, oh, well, we've worked out how to do this, and so we'll just do it with the tools we've got.
Because we've always had in our profession a sort of can-do attitude, and we've always been, if we're lucky, we're busy. Like, I've got to make 20 things, and I've got 5 days to do it, so if there's a tool that'll help me do it, let's go. I don't even have time to think about it. I think one of the issues in our field is that most people are too busy to take a step back and go, this is what we can do, but is it what we should do? Or this tool does the job, but is it the ideal way? The ability for some busy people like you to say, I'm going to join the W3C CSS working group, even though I'm busy, and run my own company and have a full lecture tour and seem to write a book every year, or more than one, and an article every day. I'm going to take time out and do this because it's important. And that's not putting people, most people just can't, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think it's really difficult. And I also think that something I've been trying to explain to people is that actually each one of us, you know, if you've got a suggestion for CSS, you can actually just go and like tell the CSS working group about it. If you've got use cases that aren't solved by existing CSS, you can go and you can raise an issue. Now all the specs are on GitHub. You can go and raise an issue and start discussing this thing that you can't do. And there's a few things that I've been posting up there which are around stuff that we can't do yet with grid, for instance. And I think that there are the sort of typical example is the kind of masonry Pinterest type layout that people want to be able to do, which isn't quite solved. It's a bit of a funny thing. It's a bit of a mixture between grid stuff and flexbox stuff. And at the moment we don't have a way of doing that, but people want to do it. And so that's something that I've been talking about and sort of collecting use cases and saying, well, maybe we can do this in the future, you know.
I think that as designers, we want to think we want absolute control, which nobody really has on the web, but we all want it, right? Designers and developers are control freaks. Otherwise, we would do something else for a living, right? But we also want, I mean, I've been talking about rules-based design since the days of table layouts, the idea that we're not sure how this is going to appear, so let's make some rules for this headline should be twice as big as this body copy, whatever that turns out to be, and there should be a gutter of at least 1/5 the width of the photo between the photo and this thing, whatever that turns out to be. There's this desire a lot of times to solve a certain problem. We need it to be like, we want a masonry thing for, I mean, it's perfect for say a responsive Tumblr or responsive Flickr, responsive Instagram, and it's and then it's the exact opposite of what we want for other things. So, and getting everything into one spec is always tricky. That's another part, right? Because if it becomes too cumbersome, too complicated, it has too much stuff in it. You've written about that in the past where it, you know, people say Grid has too much stuff in it. And you've said that that's sort of like saying Microsoft Office has too much stuff in it.
Yeah.
Right? It has too much stuff in it if you want to write an email. But if you need to do, if you need word art or you need a table, it has just enough stuff. And maybe, what are some of the things, why are people afraid of Grid? And will they be less afraid now that it's in browsers and now that they can talk about it on GitHub? Because I think that removed a lot of friction, moving to GitHub instead of a private mailing list.
Yeah, I mean the mail list you could always go and have a look at, but they, you know, if you signed up, you'd get this horrendous torrent of stuff, you know, and having to pick through it. Whereas at least with GitHub, well, that's kind of where everyone is anyway.
Right.
So you can go to GitHub and you can look and you can raise issues. We all know how to raise issues, and a spec really is just like any bit of software. Really, it has problems which need fixing, and there are things that need discussed. So it kind of works quite well on GitHub. It enables actual spec editors to interact with the sort of questions that people have, which
finally,
is great.
It's great.
Yeah.
It's
great. I think that's really good. And it's good for the specs because we need those use cases. I mean, any software, you know, benefits from sort of hearing the use cases of people who use it. It's just like me with Perch. You know, I need to hear from my customers what they need out of the CMS. And I need to hear from a lot of them. Because I need to get those generic use cases out of very specific things that people want to do.
Hear from real people. Take a stab at solving the problem. Put it out there. See if it works.
Yeah, and see, and the specs are the same. You know, if you could sort of say, oh well, we think this would solve this problem, and then someone else will say, yeah, but that won't solve my problem. And we're like, oh well, their problem's kind of similar, and you know, you. It's the same with any software like that. And I think that that's something that, you know, we can do a bit more of with GitHub, that people can just start to discuss the things around the specs and realize they're not built in a vacuum. There's a lot of people adding feedback, and I'd like more and more developers and designers to offer feedback to the process.
Yeah. We have to take a quick commercial break. I want to thank our sponsor, Incapsula. As we all know, the web can be a dangerous place. Incapsula is a cloud service that makes your website faster and safer. They have a worldwide network that inspects every packet that comes and goes from a site, blocking attacks against your site while delivering your content to users and customers faster. Now, with a global network of 30 data centers and 3 terabits of bandwidth, Encapsula sits in between your servers and your customers, routing and filtering traffic. Attack traffic like scraping bots, denial of service attacks, those things don't happen. They never make it to your server. They're blocked. Meanwhile, your content is cached and connections are optimized using their CDN. So content is still delivered lightning fast, even when there's an attack happening. Encapsula's custom software and servers, plus their 24/7 operations team, keep it all running. They protect and accelerate over 4 million websites every single day, from individual bloggers, like the people on this podcast, all the way up to Fortune 500 companies. And because Encapsula is a division of Imperva, an experienced security company, you know your site's in safe hands. Now, every day, websites of all sizes do get attacked. Criminals use giant botnets to scrape website content, try to break into databases, and bring sites down with denial of services attacks. And it's not just criminals, folks. It's not just criminals anymore. On the performance side, customers are obviously impatient, and sites that take even 3 seconds to load can turn off potential customers. We know this. We've all seen this. Everybody in the field knows if your site takes 3 seconds to load, people are gone. If your site goes down or is unavailable, customers will definitely go somewhere else. Encapsula solves all those problems. So, Encapsula is offering a special deal to Big Web Show listeners. Just visit Encapsula.com, Big Web Show, and enter the code Big Web Show, all one word, and you'll get 1 month free. Right? So, again, go to Encapsula.com, Encapsula.com/Big Web Show, enter the code Big Web Show, all one word, and get 1 month free so you can just try it out and see how it helps. Here's a fun fact. They call their custom-built packet scrubbing servers behemoths, because they can handle 500 million packets per second. That means their network handles, their network handles 11 million requests per second. So that's encapsula.com/Big Web Show, code Big Web Show for 1 free month. Check them out, because they let us bring you this show. Thank you, and thank you, Rachel. Rachel, I read somewhere in one of your articles, you said that you were updating some slides, for a better part, in fact, and you realized that you were removing a lot of complexity from your presentation, from a presentation that you'd given in May. Right? So what's changed, and how did this simplification happen? And talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, that was about grid gaps, which is a property, right, to enable some sort of gutter or alley between the cells of your grid.
Initially, they didn't have that, and you had to hack it by saying, this column will be 10 pixels wide. And it
right.
Wasn't a column,
so what you'd have to have would be, you'd have your tracks that were kind of your content tracks, and then you'd have these little mini tracks that would be your gutter tracks.
Workable, but a hack.
Yeah, but also just meant that things like the auto placement, where you can have a grid and throw a bunch of content, well, then auto placement was going to stick stuff into those skinny tracks, which isn't what you wanted.
Right.
So I'd been presenting and saying, we need some sort of gap. We need something like the column gap property in multi-column layout, is what I was saying. Can we please have this? And at one point it was like, oh, well, we'll look at that for level 2 of the spec. And I just carried on going on about it. And eventually it was Fantasy, who's one of the spec editors, saw me talk at a conference in Amsterdam, and she wrote it into the spec. So we got the gaps, and it was great because I could strip all this complicated fiddly stuff out of the examples I had that I was presenting on, because suddenly we didn't have to work around these little tracks all the time.
Do you notice a difference in the audience with that stuff removed, or have you not been able to present the simpler yet?
I presented that stuff, and I think it just immediately made it easier to explain. And I think that is actually quite a good thing for a spec. You know, if you can explain these things in simple ways, you know, anything or any bit of software actually you're working on, if you can explain it in a simple way, that's, you're going kind of in the right direction. You know, if you have to make all kinds of weird mental leaps in order to understand something, you know, that's just going to cause people problems.
A simple mental model increases the chance that people will use and adapt something. It's the same way in Hollywood. If I say, so there's 30 characters and they have rich, complicated lives and interact with each other in strange ways, and that's, nobody's going to buy that. And if I say, it's, you've got mail for the iPad set or whatever, that's really stupid. It's a dumb, but that's what people do all the time. It's, you've got mail meets Frankenstein, or
you need to be able to explain things simply. And I think, you know, that's really important, say, for adoption and for people actually just getting to grips with something, and it not being this horrendously complicated thing that no one wants to use. Because, you know, it's important that everybody can use this stuff, and that it's not, you know, just another layer of horrendous sort of stuff we have to grok. And that's what annoys me a bit about people marching around saying, oh, this is so difficult. So it's like, well,
why
it's
do
not,
they? Why do they?
It's not difficult, Ed. I don't know whether it is, you know, people wanting to say, oh, this is very difficult and I have mastered it. I don't know what that's about. Or if it's people who don't want to learn something and so are just like, oh, it's far too complex. This is a very complex thing. I don't really want to learn it at the moment. I haven't got time.
People who've learned Flexbox seem to have an easy time transitioning.
Yes. Yeah. Well, there's an awful lot that's similar. And by design, there's a lot that's similar. Both specs use the same, you know, the box alignment stuff. So all the properties there are pretty much the same. I mean, obviously, you've got differences because on grid, you've got two axes, you've got two dimensions to align things against. But this stuff works very similar. The FR unit works very similarly to Flex Basis in Flexbox. So I think if you understand how Flexbox works, it's not difficult to transition that over to using grid.
Now, when people started doing print design, when computers first came into print design, and when PostScript came along, people wrote it by hand at first, had to. Mm-hmm. And there was tremendous pride in that. And nowadays, no print designer has to do that. So I'm going to ask you the question. Most developers will say no to this, and I myself don't see how it could possibly happen. But will there ever be a time when I can make a layout in some purely visual tool, create a few responsive instances in it by dragging things around, and then that tool will generate smart CSS, smart HTML, only the JavaScript that's absolutely needed and with fallbacks? Is that ever going to happen?
I think that grid layout possibly gets us closer. I've always been very interested in this stuff because I did all that work with Dreamweaver. And what Dreamweaver was fantastic at was table-based layouts.
Right.
Because you could take your design and you could just sort of break it up, and it would do all the nasty nested tables for you. It would work it all out. You didn't have to figure that stuff out for yourself.
Especially when we were setting type in Photoshop, not because we didn't have any web fonts. So
yeah, I mean,
it would slice and
worked.
Dice. Right.
Yeah, so Dreamweaver was really, really good at doing those table-based layouts. And the minute we went to CSS positioning, then Dreamweaver started, you know, sticking in all this awful stuff and doing things with absolute positioning, so everything would sort of be stacked up in the corner and would be, you know, all positioned from the top and left and would overflow if you had too much text.
Still exists, by the way. It's part of the Adobe Cloud Suite, although nobody in our field, I don't think, uses it.
No, you don't. But I mean, at one point, everyone used Dreamweaver, really.
Absolutely.
It was very, very prevalent. Now, I think that CSS grid layout,
well, I didn't, but I felt like such a stud.
Yeah, but a lot of the people who didn't use it would be like, oh, but I do use the code editor, because it actually had a very good code editor built in, you know.
Absolutely. With color coding and sort of...
Yeah, for its time, it was fantastic. But anyway, I think that grid layout potentially gets us closer to that. I think there are definitely issues in that with a visual tool, it would be very easy for people to kind of just drag things around and not worry about the logical sort of source order.
Right.
And that is a potential problem for any visual tool.
And structure.
Yes. because it's a bit like, oh, because, you know, literally anything that's a direct child of the grid, you could put anywhere on the grid. But that could make an awful mess for someone, for instance, tabbing around using the keyboard.
It's like if you see someone who doesn't know what they're doing using a page layout tool, instead of creating a style and then reusing that style, they keep on setting. It's the way maybe your mom would use Microsoft Word. And every time she sets a headline, it's still body, it's still normal, or whatever the default is, and she just styles that instance. And then, you know, a few lines later, not to say anything about your mom, I'm very sorry. I just mean in general, and that's ages too. I'm apologizing to everybody in the world. But just as an example, my dad, who's a brilliant engineer, but the default way that he would use Microsoft Word is that he basically everything's one style. And then he picks fonts for each thing. It's just, it's a natural
it's a non-technical way of thinking about these things. It's like, it's just sort of like, oh, you know, I just need to change this, the way this one thing looks.
And that's always been the way most apps approached this problem. So if you were to set, you know, if you were to set three headlines exactly the same way, the tool wouldn't be smart enough to know you intended them all to be the same style. You could go into the code view, or maybe there was a tool to touch all three places and say, these are all H2s, and then it would sort of figure it out. I worked with early versions of Macau just to test it out, and that actually looked pretty promising. Have you tried that at all, Macau?
I had a very brief look at it, but no, I mean, I'm not really a visual tool type person. I mean, me using Photoshop is utterly hilarious.
Okay.
you talk about non-technical people using things, then that's me there. Anyone who thinks I know what I'm talking about should watch me try and use any of these applications.
Well, that's brilliant in a way. You're like, you know, thank goodness that you're not a visual person, because if you were, that would be one less person explaining CSS grid to the rest of us. So.
It's funny. I have no ability to understand any icons. So I spend an awful lot of time just staring at my phone because it doesn't make any sense to me. Like what icon means which thing. I certainly have an interesting set of challenges.
Now, are you going to have to update, get ready for CSS grid?
Yes, that's the thing we wanted to do. We kind of got that book out sort of just around the time that the Gutter stuff changed. So I'd like to update that really for those points. Most of it is pretty much current, because by that point, really the stuff that was changing the spec was an awful lot of sort of finer detail, which I don't really go into in that book, because it is essentially just an introduction.
And the thing is, it's an ebook only. As soon as you have time, right? It's not something that happened instantly. But it means that everyone who bought it basically just gets the new, you know, when they open their book tool, iBook, Kindle, whatever, they just get, you know, they're notified that there's a new edition.
Yeah, I think that's the best thing for anything that's a rapidly changing thing. The ebook only route is fantastic, because you can go back and update it and make changes to in terms of what's changed. So
I love books. I love printed books. I love holding them. Especially, I mean, obviously, if it's a graphic novel or something, you just have to get that version. It's just not as satisfying on a digital device. But I feel, as a publisher, like for any technical topic, ebook only just makes so much more sense. Because I would love to be able to take the last book I wrote and just, you know, fix the little bits that change. Every 6 months, just go in and fix what needs changing, and have a constantly updated resource for people. It's a lot of work. I wonder if we'll have a subscription model for books at some point, like we do for TV, like Netflix and Hulu.
I think that kind of would work quite well for a lot of the stuff that people are writing these days. You know, that is going to change. You know, if you're writing about, say, new JavaScript or anything like that, or new PHP, or, you know, any of these languages, things change actually pretty quickly. And it would be nice to be able to say, well, look, subscribe to my book, and I'm going to ship, you know, three updates a year or whatever.
Or Eric Meyer does these books on CS, like the whole everything about CSS for O'Reilly, and they're huge. And he does one of these every few years. Wouldn't it be great if he wrote one of those for O'Reilly and you just subscribe to it and download it when there's something new? Yeah, it wouldn't you wouldn't be able to dog ear it. You wouldn't be able to put it on your desk. That's sad, but it would be on every device you own. That's cool.
Yeah, and you can search it. And it's funny, people are very split on the physical book or not thing. You know, I mean, I don't really get physical books. I travel too much. I like having the things on my Kindle so I can take them around. But then you get a lot of people are like, no, you know, I need a book. I need to hold it. I need to put it on my desk. You know, and so I think it really is quite a split in terms of how people see this stuff. And yeah, I can totally understand having a book, you know, having grown up in sort of going to the library and that being the best place.
I think ebooks work for me. This is just grandmother research. For me, I find it harder to read fiction. I find it easier to sink into a fiction story. If I love fiction, that's mainly what I read. I find that easier to do with something printed still, assuming it's readable, assuming it's not a badly printed paperback with tiny type. I find it easier to open a book and sink into a character's story. I think staring at the screen for long periods of time is wearying on my eyes. But for books about history, about technology, about design, I think that the screen is perfect because, like you say, you can have a library of 200 books that you carry around with you.
You don't
necessarily read those books for 4, 5, 6 hours at a time. You basically, you go through them once, taking breaks, and then after that, you dip into the sections. What did Rachel Andrews say about nested grids and subgrids? I have to go back and look that up. And then you do. And it works perfectly well because you're going to spend about 10 minutes looking at something and refreshing your memory, or 10 minutes looking at code. It's great. I wish it were easier to copy and paste from ebooks in an app. You can do it on a desktop reader, right? But it's harder to do. Yeah, you can do it on a desktop reader, but it's much harder to do on a phone. Well, anything to do with selecting text is still a little harder on a phone, I find.
Maybe
it's how fast I tap my fingers. I have to take another quick commercial break. Please, thank you very much for bearing with me. These pokes are important. And I want to talk to the folks, especially people in their own business, freelancers, folks at small studios, that segment of the audience. Hello, come on into the microphone. You know, when you're running your own agency, wrapping up one project while starting another means you need healthy cash flow to keep things moving. If waiting for a client's check to show up in the mail is slowing your business down, it's time for FreshBooks. FreshBooks makes ridiculously easy-to-use cloud accounting software for agencies and freelancers, software that'll help you work smarter, become more organized, and most importantly, get you paid quickly. Here are some things to know about the all-new FreshBooks. It's been rebuilt and redesigned from the ground up, and it's custom-built for the way you work. The design team at FreshBooks is really good. They've done a lot of work, and they're offering what they believe to be the simplest way to be more productive, more organized, and get paid quickly. With the new projects feature, you can share files and messages with your clients, contractors, and employees. See how quickly things happen when all your conversations live in one place. There's a notification center, which is like a personal assistant for you. So you'll always know what's changed in your business since you last log in and what needs to be dealt with pronto, like overdue invoices. I'm kind of a broken record on that, but I think anyone in business for themselves knows how important it is to get that client payment that you're due. And you know, this, as soon as you log in, it tells you what's due. As soon as FreshBooks also sends you notifications, so you know, hey, you know, it's been 30 days since you asked the client to reimburse you for that expense and they haven't yet. You should do something about that. It's also really easy to send professional looking invoices in under 30 seconds. I have, for me, because I'm a designer and always dissatisfied and a control freak, almost every invoice I send looks different than the one. But I'm constantly redoing. I don't even have letterhead. I have what I was describing in terms of like the imaginary Eric Meyer's book that keeps updating itself. That's my letterhead. It's like, oh, I changed the positioning of the phone number today. Anyway, so for me, I'll go into a black hole instead of just billing and moving on. So for me, FreshBooks is a great way to just hit send and get paid. You can take pictures of your receipts on your phone using the FreshBooks mobile app. There's just a million features, and I can't talk about them all because I could spend the whole day doing that. So instead, we've got an unrestricted free trial for listeners of The Big Web Show. To get your month-long unrestricted free trial, go to freshbooks.com/bigwebshow, and in the section called How Did You Hear About Us, enter the words Big Web Show. That's three separate words, Big Web Show. Go to freshbooks.com/bigwebshow, enter Big Web Show when they ask How Did You Hear About Us, and enjoy a month of FreshBooks, and just see if it doesn't simplify your life and help you get paid faster. Okay, and we're back with Rachel Andrew, author of 30 books, including Get Ready for CSS Grid Layout, CSS Layout, 3 Layout Modules, and The Profitable Side Project Handbook. Tell us about that one. How did that book come about?
I was writing quite a bit about sort of bootstrapping a product. I guess it came from a time when the whole sort of venture capital thing was, everybody I knew who wanted to start anything were sort of by default thinking, how do I get VC money to do my thing? And we'd kind of launched Perch with no money at all. And just sort of, you know, put out this little thing as a side project, which
did you make it for yourself? Did you make
Perch Yeah, it was, we've always done sort of fairly big content management stuff. And we were doing that for agencies, and they then sort of were asking for something smaller and lighter that could sort of just be dropped into an existing site.
So you'd been doing custom CMS work for agencies, yes, and studios. Okay.
Yeah, fairly big, sort of fairly large scale stuff. And
museums, and, yes, newspapers, BBC, yeah,
this was just
that kind
big,
of thing.
Big content jobs. And right. So we knew a lot about managing content really well, and also making sure that the front end, that people could do, you know, whatever they wanted with the front end. They could use whatever code, whatever CSS, and so on. So that was kind of important to us. And so we wanted to do the same sort of thing, but on a very tiny scale. And that's, so, you know, the sort of the situation for Perch was always, you've built a website, it's just HTML, you've got no CMS behind it. And then the client says, oh, I'd like to be able to edit the text on my homepage. And
wow.
What you don't want to do is then have to like turn all of that into a WordPress theme or something. And so that was really the initial thinking behind Perch, was what if we could just drop in a CMS that still let you keep all of your front end code exactly as it is. You know, you don't have to change anything. And so that was really where it came from. We built it initially for us, because we thought we'd like to have this because it will let us build these things very quickly for people.
Is it PHP?
It's
like
PHP.
And is it some tags that you can wrap around basically like opening and okay.
So basically you put in a PHP tag, which is essentially a function call which calls up Perch, and then you create a template which has all of your fields in that you want the person to edit, but also has your markup in. So if you want, you know, if your heading needs to have a class on it, then you can do that, or whatever. So you add that, and then when you go and load that up in the admin, your template becomes your schema, and that's then what the person fills in. So it's the sort of the basics are very, very simple.
Now, listening to that origin story, it reminds me in a way of mobile first. Almost the same concept. The concept of mobile first was, instead of figuring out how are we going to cram this big website that's full of crap that everyone on the board of directors wanted on the homepage, how are we going to cram that into a tiny phone screen? Instead, it says, what does the customer want to do? What's the one or two things they really need to do? Let's design from there. And in a way, what you're saying is, instead of saying, how do we take the powerful CMSs that we've been building and just make them easier to use, or like which features can we cut, which would be how most people would approach this. All right, I'm used to making these complex, very powerful CMSs. What features can I cut in order to make a lower budget, simpler, easier to use CMS? You didn't do that at all. You said, we're going to start with the document. We're going to start with HTML. Let's let our customer write a flat file. And now, what's the minimum thing they need to do to be able to turn that into a CMS? I think that's an intriguing approach.
Yeah, because a lot of the even today, and we're, you know, we're like 8 years on from the launch of Perch. Even today, a lot of people are still in that situation. They've got something very simple. They just want to make a little bit of it editable. And while we've got a bigger product, we've got Perch Runway, which is for your larger scale. We've kind of come full circle. We've now got a product which does the big stuff. But
is there an upgrade path?
Yes, there is. I mean, that's one of the things, is that the nice thing, because the template language is the same between the two, you can upgrade a Perch site, a simple site, into a Runway site pretty seamlessly. And we did it with a whole bunch of our sites immediately, you know, because actually, so Runway is a bit more of kind of your developer's version of Perch, I would say. I mean, not that it's difficult to use, but it's, I think, if you're a developer, you look at Runway like, yeah, that's how I want to build websites, I think. Whereas if you don't like dealing with PHP and you don't really want to do back-end stuff, I think people look at Perch and like, oh, yes, this seems like a more straightforward way to work.
As a product designer, how much of your innovation comes just purely from what customers are asking for, and how much research, competitive research, do you do? Do you make stuff in Expression Engine and Craft and Drupal and WordPress and see how those platforms are evolving, and then go, this is an interesting feature, what could we do that's like this? Or is it purely customer driven? How does that
work? It's from the customers. I haven't installed anything else for a very long time, and I don't, because it's not about what our competitors are doing, it's about what our customers want. And you know, I think we've got different types of customers. We've got a lot of people who come from WordPress, certainly. And you know, we have a very different sort of customer base to some of those other systems, and that's cool, because you know, there's such a huge amount of variety in what people want from a CMS. You know, that there can be all of these sort of competing, as it were, systems. And that's fine, because the market is enormous.
Who's your, you know, the platonic customer? I know you have lots of people, but if you were to give me a scenario, if you were to give me a persona, is it a one-person shop operated out of a home with local business clients? Is it a small studio, or is there just so many that you can't do that?
It's very, very broad. It's very much targeted at people who are building websites for clients, both Perch and Runway. I would say that the typical Perch user are individuals up to small shops. I mean, we've got some very, very successful customers who essentially build kind of, say, the same site, but very similar sites for a certain vertical. So yeah, we've got people who have, you know, hundreds of like doctors' websites, and that's all they build.
Right.
And Perch is brilliant for them, because they can have all their templates that they've created, that, you know, to do different kinds of editing of the sort of things that doctors want on their website. And so they can very quickly roll out, you know, these new websites with probably a new design, or, you know, maybe they use some templates or whatever, but that, you know, they might totally redesign the actual front end. But all of the content management stuff, all of their sort of Perch templates, they can reuse from project to project. So we have some very successful, quite big agencies who do that sort of work and use Perch for it.
Do you go around to these ad agencies pitching the product, or they just come to you?
They just kind of show up. I mean, we're not very good at, we should do better really at promoting the product. It's been very much sort of word of mouth. Our customers tell other people and say, hey, because obviously everyone talks to each other at meetups and what have you. But yeah, it's always interesting.
You're not at South by Southwest this week, for example.
No.
At a booth promoting Perch.
No, we've done that once or twice at a conference.
60,000 or however. I mean, it's a crazy. There's so many people at South by now.
I don't know how it's quite difficult to sort of promote something like this, particularly for Perch, because our best customers are just really, really busy people, and they're not actually in the web community as much as you might think. So we don't have a big sort of echo chamber of people talking about Perch, because they're not typically tinkerers. They're people who are just like earning a living building websites. So that's made it sometimes a little difficult, because when we reach out to these people and say, you know, we'd really love to kind of feature you and talk about what you're doing, and they're like, oh yeah, well, maybe when we've got some time, you know, but they don't have time because they're busy. And we're serving a fantastic purpose for these people, and it's finding out how to advertise that to other people like them is kind of difficult.
Now, you're talking about people who are too busy, and that's great. That's most people. One of the things that has happened with people who are too busy, people in our field, with developers especially, is that we've made it a thing to use frameworks for everything. And I have colleagues who are graphic designers who studied graphic design at prestigious art colleges and universities who still, they start every project by going to Bootstrap. So do you think, and I'm getting back to Grid, do you think that CSS Grid, in a way, can replace, and I don't mean let's make Bootstrap in CSS Grid. I think that's not what I'm saying. But do you think something like Grid can replace, for busy people, once they get over that learning curve, that couple of days where they have to just watch your videos and read some books and read some articles and watch Jen Simmons' videos and just go, okay, now I get it. And maybe, do some exercises so they can actually, because nothing beats working with a technology. Once they're comfortable, do you think people could just, do you think we'll see a transition away from, and again, I'm not putting these tools down. I'm just saying, do you think they sort of define the way web design is done right now? Do you think we're about to move past that and into an era where we have more powerful CSS tools and can do more with them and less with frameworks?
Yeah, it's interesting because the frameworks don't just have a grid component. In fact, you can use the frameworks without using their grid component if you want to. So the frameworks, I mean, I'm talking about things like, I guess, Bootstrap and Foundation are probably the biggest case in point. Now, we actually use Foundation for quite a lot of our stuff because neither Drew or myself, we're not designers. And so what Foundation gives us, we tend not to actually use a lot of the grid stuff because we do a lot of this stuff with Flexbox. We'll be able to do a lot of this stuff with grid layout. What a framework gives people is, some decisions have been made around, how things are going to sort of be, some shape to it, which if you're not a designer, is actually quite nice, because I can look at it and say, sure. Well, okay, it's not beautiful, but, say for our Perch documentation, which uses Foundation, right? I've got some documentation and I want to be able to display that in a way that's not going to make people's eyes bleed. And I don't want to spend hours and hours and hours trying to sort this out. And so that works really well, and you can sort of use the bits of the framework that that serve you there. And you could also, you could quite easily use those bits of the framework without using the grid. You could then use CSS Grid Layout. So I think, and I've said this to Jen as well, because I think what would be interesting would be how can we create things that give people the kind of, if you're a developer, they give you some of the design guidance you're wanting, which I think is why a lot of developers use frameworks. If you're a designer, perhaps they give you some help more with the technical side of things, but without sort of constraining you into this, oh, well, here are the 5-6 layouts that you're allowed to make with this thing.
Right.
And I think that's
how would that work, though? How would they connect up?
I think they're probably two slightly different things, but I think that, for the we're saying, oh, everyone should just hire a designer, but that's not realistic for a lot of people. And for some things,
right,
as a small business, you've got to choose where to put your money.
Right.
So, for instance, getting someone to design our documentation, that's just not something we have money for. It'd be lovely if we could employ someone to actually do all this stuff and do a beautiful job of it. I would love that. I'm not in that position. So, and I think, someone doing an open source project or someone, you can't always throw money at this. And so having the frameworks, I think, gives people from all different areas of the web something to start with. And how do we create those things for people to start with that don't also kind of accidentally, drive people into a path of, oh, well, everything has to look like this or everything has to work like this. And that is an interesting question. And it would be nice to have things that give people starting points, give people best practices, because a framework can do an awful lot to help people into good practices. If the alternative is them dragging things around in Dreamweaver, for instance, there's a lot that a framework can actually do to hand help people and say, well, actually, this is a really good way to do this. A framework can promote accessibility if it wants to. They can,
But do they?
I think that people have started to try to do that, and I think that is something that I mean, if you think, I mean, obviously, if you build something custom and you really, really work hard at accessibility and at performance and things, you're going to be able to do a better job than a generic thing. However, if you don't work at that stuff at all, I think that it's quite likely, I mean, I don't have any hard data, but I think it's probably quite likely that a framework that's bothered to think about this stuff, at least at a basic level, is probably going to do better than someone who really isn't caring about it.
Right.
And so I think...
Especially with accessibility, it seems like it's still, we're still having the same arguments that we've been having for 20 years. You still have to sell it like it's not a default setting. Accessibility is not a default specification. It's not a requirement for most clients.
And that's
it should be, but it's crazy. And people say, well, they're not paying me enough for that.
Right.
Right. It's like, well, we should, and we're always compromised. Well, we should have had 2 more weeks to do research, but they weren't paying us, so we're basically going to go on our knowledge. And we're, you know, it would be nice if we had, but since we don't, we're just going to, we'll try to write good HTML, and that should do most of it. I mean, testing with people with disabilities is probably not going to happen, even though that should happen on every project.
But I guess, you know, that's the thing, though, that, you know, a framework with a big framework that has the resources could potentially be testing all these components.
Yes.
And so, actually, there's a kind of a possibility for good there. Now, I know that like Jen would argue that, but this is kind of stopping people being creative and stopping people, doing sort of more interesting things on the web. And there's certainly an argument there. But I think it's what are you trying to do with that site? And it kind of comes down to this whole, you know, well, it depends, and it always depends.
And so it
would be nice. What I do hope doesn't happen is that these frameworks just sort of create their own bizarre implementation of grid on top of grid.
Right.
And sort of try and abstract, do this sort of abstraction on top, because I don't think they need to do that. I think pretty much you can do what Foundation does, what Bootstrap does, just natively with grid layout, plus some. So it'd be nicer if they said, hey, you don't need, we're not going to add a grid. When we go to using CSS Grid for your grids, we're not going to add that grid part of the framework. We're just going to use the native CSS because you can use it.
Right.
And guide people into using that. Because, as I say, I think the grid framework part of the frameworks is separate from just there being frameworks. And maybe we don't get too confused.
Fair enough. I want to pause here for 1 second. Thank a sponsor. You were talking about not everybody needs a powerful CMS. Not everybody can hire a designer. Not everybody is going to dive into the complexity. I think most of our listeners are very much interested in these things, but not everybody. And not every client who comes to you can afford you. And what do you say to someone who comes to you and wants a good website but literally has no money? Well, one thing you can say, or one thing you can do if you're the person in that situation, is jumpstart 2017 with a stunning new website created by you with Wix.com. With Wix.com, that potential customer but with no money, or you yourself, if you're not a designer, you can create a great website all by yourself. It's easy. You just use the drag and drop editor to customize everything. Add your text, images, videos, and more. Wix makes it easy to get your stunning website looking exactly the way you want. No technical skills needed. Nothing we've discussed in this podcast today is needed. You can make a site pretty much right away, and it's mobile optimized, so you look great on any device. Whatever you need a website for, Wix has you covered. So start that blog or showcase your artistic talent in a beautiful portfolio. You can even grow your business with a stunning online store or simply explore new ideas. Over 97 million people choose Wix to create their website. Make yours happen in 2017. It's easy and free. Just go to Wix.com, that's Wix.com, and create your stunning website today. Thank you, Wix, for your support of the Big Web Show. And for Big Web Show listeners who've tuned in today to hear about CSS Grid, here is an example of something you can do when a neighbor, a friend, a relative comes to you and needs help, and they need to put up a website, and you can't help them for whatever reason. You can turn them on to Wix.com. It really does work very well, and it's pretty much what many people need, right? Obviously, you're not going to put the BBC on it, but pretty much any other smaller business can work very well on Wix.com. So thanks, Wix, and thanks to all the sponsors of today's podcast, and thanks, Rachel Andrew, for coming on the show today and for all the work that you do to help people in our industry advance and understand and do better. I didn't even mention you're a technical contributor to A List Apart, technical editor at A List Apart. You're the co-founder of edgeofmyseat.com. How much client work do you do these days, or is Perch the full-time gig now?
Perch is pretty much the sort of client work I tend to do now is stuff sort of specifically related to things like the sort of CSS layout stuff I do. We don't tend to build stuff for people anymore. We do a little bit of, if someone wants something very specific for Perch, for instance, because we have an API and we can build add-ons for Perch. So sometimes we'll do a little bit of work, you know, building a custom add-on for someone. But that's pretty much, so Drew's pretty much full-time on Perch. I do bits and bobs of consultancy around CSS, or I might be hired to do some writing or whatever, because it's kind of interesting to be able to use that stuff for a client. But yeah, we don't do a lot of client work, and we don't really see ourselves as a sort of consultancy anymore as we were.
Now, you're working on a series of videos about CSS Grid. Are those out yet?
There's a bunch of videos. Yeah, I've got a bunch of free videos on gridbyexample.com/video. There's 20, I think, at this point. I also have a sort of a paid tutorial workshop, which is essentially my 2-day CSS layout workshop as an online thing, which people can pay for. But it's so that's at the CSSworkshop.com. So that's sort of something I'd excited to say. I've got this workshop that I do at conferences and things, and I sort of turned it into an online version, which I'm sort of keeping up to date with the in-person one as things change.
Your next two shows are Confu in Vancouver and an event apart in Seattle.
Yeah, no, I've done Confu. I think event apart's my next one.
Okay,
she says looking at her speaking list.
Okay, that's in a few
weeks.
Oh,
I'm doing Render. So I'm at Render at the end of March in
What's
the UK.
That?
So that's a front end development conference in Oxford in the UK.
Nice.
Render conference. So yeah, I'm doing that. Then I'm in Seattle, and then I'm doing a Smashing Conf. So that's
Smashing in San Francisco.
Yeah.
Talk and full day workshop, and then Front End United in Athens, Greece.
Yes, yeah. There's a whole bunch of stuff coming up. It's the usual spring conference. I've had a nice few weeks at home, and
me too.
And then it all kicks off, doesn't it?
It will be delightful to see you at some of those places. I'm really looking
forward to that. I'm really looking forward to being back on the road at the Venter Park. Is always good fun.
So. Boston as well. You'll be in a Venter Park.
Yes.
Boston.
Yeah.
This is great. Yeah. Thank you very much for everything today and for all your work, your advocacy on behalf. People don't even know that you and Drew basically got web standards into Dreamweaver in the late 90s, early 2000s. So really, really thank you for everything. It's been a wonderful show, and we'll see you soon. And listeners, thank you for listening, and we'll be back with another Big Web Show in a couple of weeks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.